Senator Flake, you've announced that you're not running for re-election, and I wonder, could you have done this if you were running for re-election?
No. Not a chance.
Not a chance.
No.
Because politics has become too sharp, too partisan.
Yeah, there's no value to reaching across the aisle. There's no currency for that anymore. There's no incentive.
That was America's most hated senator. Not hyperbole, by the way, although Mitch McConnell is usually pretty competitive. Jeff Flake, peacocking, in the words of the Federalist's Ben Domenech on 60 Minutes last night after the senator's dramatic last ditch, 1 week delay Friday of the Senate's confirmation vote for controversial Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. A happy 163rd game of baseball to you all. I am Matt Welch, and this is the Reason Podcast, Monday Editor's Roundtable Edition. Before we leap into the commentary quagmire, a reminder, if you're listening to this through the Reason website or if someone sent you a link or whatever, just subscribe to us at iTunes already. It's a lot easier that way. It goes straight on your little deal and you can do the thing. Okay. On the horn with me, per usual, is Reason stalwarts Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie. Good morning, comrades.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Happy Monday to all of you.
Hi. So I wanted to start this latest in our Kavanaugh hearings is Ripping America Apart podcast. This is the third or the fourth. I'm not sure which. By taking a kind of gut check.
Of an infinite number. Let's be clear. We're going to be doing this every week.
Infinitely
forever.
Recurring number. Libertarians have a reputation, some of you might have heard, of being super hyper-rationalist automatons, lacking in the empathy gene, basically Peter Suderman's Twitter feed minus the drinking. And since everyone else in America seems to be having an emotional political breakdown, I wanted to get our sort of emotional response, Catherine, to the gripping testimony and reaction thereof from Thursday in particular, from accuser Christine Blasey Ford and her alleged assaulter, Brett Kavanaugh. How are you feeling, Catherine?
Wow. You wanted to ask the lady how she feels about the
Absolutely.
Rape?
Absolutely.
Good opener. So I mean, to be honest, and this is a weasel answer and also probably feeds stereotypes about libertarian automatons, but I feel bad about American politics right now. I just feel very, very bad about it. And I think that it is bad, but I also do feel bad about it. And my kind of read as the hearing was going on was, you know, I was sort of streaming it, though I was on an Amtrak train, so that was infuriating. I was in Reason's Slack channel watching responses in there. I was on Twitter, and I also had a text thread with my book club, who I have discussed here before, which is full of nice DC liberal ladies. And
Can you publish that?
No.
I want to. That's
no.
What I'm most interested
17
in.
17 kinds of no. But the unmixed, hyper-partisan rage on every side had such intensity, and it represented such different perceptions of the same event. The one thing that did seem to bring people together, though, was like, this is a sad, bad mess. Like, the fact that this is the past that we are at, this is what we are as a nation sitting and watching, like, with our popcorn, none of that felt good, but mostly the sense in which everyone saw what they came to see and walked away more righteously indignant than before.
Nick, I know you're weeping Indian by the roadside, looking at garbage tears for your country right now. What what were your other kind of responses as this was unfolding?
So, Matt, I would say, just to cut to the chase, I think that Blasey Ford, there was, you know, something happened to her. She didn't convince me that it was Kavanaugh. And I also think I'm not fully certain that it would be disqualifying on his part if her account was totally true, unless he lied about it. And I don't know that we'll ever, you know, fully find that out. We've got the FBI investigation coming on. What I thought was most interesting was less about her performance, which, you know, everybody was, you know, giving high fives on, and she was definitely credible and came across differently than I think most people anticipated and worried or feared. But his kind of righteous, teary-eyed moment was kind of interesting from a performance of masculinity. That's the type of thing, if he had done that 20 years ago, that would have been the end for him. And it's kind of interesting that men are able to tear up in a way that I don't think anybody was really kind of anticipating.
So the important thing here is that middle-class white men are now more self-actualized.
Absolutely.
Probably, yeah.
Catherine.
You know, they're owning their emotions, finally.
It's often the most important thing.
Peter, I know that you are like Randall Patrick McMurphy after the lobotomy these days, so I'm going to ask you a more evidence-based question, which is there are two kind of dueling sort of narratives or interpretations of the facts out there that are getting wide distribution, having to do with who is more credible or just their comparative credibility angles. One from this morning is Rachel Mitchell, who is the prosecutor from Arizona, who is cross-examining both the witnesses, including for a while there, very interestingly, Kavanaugh, and then that was cut off, sadly. But she came out with a report. It was leaked out here. In which it said, a he said, she said case is incredibly difficult to prove, but this case is even weaker than that. That was her memo that she provided to Republican colleagues. And then on the other side, there was a pretty convincing, I think, on evidentiary basis, regardless of conclusions, Nathan Robinson, point by point kind of refutation of Kavanaugh's testimony in Current Affairs, making the point that you're seeing a lot of people say is that he just didn't seem very credible, specifically when he was talking about, you know, things like devil's triangles and yearbook interpretations and stuff. So to your mind, who is more credible or what story is more credible and why, and where should we go with that?
As I wrote last Friday, and I haven't really changed my mind about this, in part because I, too, have felt anguish and despair. And I have attempted to distract...
It's really coming across in your voice right now.
...distract myself from that anguish and despair by playing the new Spider-Man game all weekend, which we can get to more of later, I hope. But I basically, I find myself partially too fairly convinced by both sides and not entirely satisfied by any particular argument. And... The post I wrote Friday morning tried to sort of lay out both cases for both, and it was a little more procedural. It was about whether or not Republicans should just move straight to a vote. This was before the Jeff Flake thing happened and before the FBI investigation had happened. But I woke up that morning and I found myself writing emails. And by the time I would finish any single sentence where I thought I was going to definitively settle on one side or another, I would be thinking, but wait, actually, I'm not quite certain about this argument on the other side. And so what I tried to do was just sort of present both sides, both cases as best as I could and run them up against each other. And I think when you do that, it becomes very hard to make to get any clarity here. I think I'm reasonably confident that Dr. Ford is not making this up. I feel pretty strongly, in fact, that she is not making up an event out of whole cloth. This is not someone who is a strategic or tactical liar. I strongly suspect that Kavanaugh believes himself to be innocent of the particular and specific charges. What exactly happened? I think it's very, very difficult to tell, and it's impossible to know at this point. If you look at the Mitchell letter, this was the woman who was questioning Ford, and then started questioning Kavanaugh. If you look at that Mitchell letter, points out a number of discrepancies in Ford's story. On the other hand, it's a 35-year-old story by someone who underwent a trauma. It would be surprising if it were perfect and clear. And as you point out, she stopped asking Kavanaugh questions at the point that she got to what an entry in Kavanaugh's calendar from the summer of 1982 that suggests that he went to an event that was somewhat similar in terms of who was attending and in terms of the type of small sort of drinking gathering at a home that is supposed to have happened. So, you know, I think there's an awful lot of circumstantial evidence. I think that anybody who is absolutely certain that they know what happens, anybody who wasn't there anyway, who was just looking at the public evidence, I don't think you can be certain. And I think that it is a mistake to think that you know beyond a shadow of a doubt. I think that it's a mistake to think that you can really at this point, without any further evidence, have a whole lot of confidence in what happened at all. And that itself, I should say, that could support then either interpretation about what to do, because I think it is pretty reasonable to say, well, if you think it is even possible that Kavanaugh did this, then maybe he shouldn't be on the Supreme Court. I also think that it is not insane to say that we shouldn't be tarring a man this way. We shouldn't be doing, you know, sort of what a withdrawal would probably do to his life, sort of leaving a stain of uncertainty of great doubt of on his life for the rest of his life, without something more like clear evidence, and therefore this person should be confirmed. And so again, I have just given you an extended performance of uncertainty here, because that is all I have to offer you.
Long there, Catherine, go.
Yeah.
Just go, and I have some other questions for you. But go on.
I guess the thing that I wanted to talk about, which is is just a variation on Peter's uncertainty theme, is this thing that I saw again in both of my feeds, in both of my kind of windows into people's reactions, which was the conflation of credibility with truth. And I think that's something that, you know, we've talked about this before, since we are talking about Kavanaugh forever. Like, this is happening on college campuses quite a lot as well. When we think about these Title IX complaints, the distinction between this person believes what they are saying, and that gives us very much information about whether or not it's true. Like, that's a really, really important distinction. And I don't think you have to be like a fancy pants philosophy major doing some epistemology. Hey, I went to Yale, by the way, you guys.
Thanks.
I'm super annoyed that Kavanaugh has made that even douchier to say now. Like, sometimes you just have to say where you went to college. Anyway.
Later on, I'd like you to explain to us what it was like to go to Yale and tell us how
I busted my butt.
You had no connection
to Yale. I didn't have any connection.
I think you're right.
But seriously, I do think there's this weird thing where people who I know better, who I know the difference between that person believes what they are saying and that thing is true, who are choosing to elide it. And I think they, too, are doing that genuinely. I think people want so badly for there to be information in this information vacuum that they are assigning information value to feelings.
I think that that's also where the, you know, and again, the fact that we're talking about this shows, like, you know, we ran off the road some years ago that this is what we're talking about. But the therapy notes would be really helpful in that context, because, you know, she first articulated her story in therapy, in couples therapy. And a therapy setting is not about reality as much as it is about kind of creating a story or a narrative that works for the people in the room. And this is, you know, it would be helpful to understand what the larger context was to be able to shift from kind of credibility to truth claims if we want to, but we're not going to be able to do that.
So
I also think that the therapy notes thing is very similar to a situation that journalists often find themselves in, where they were like, to provide notes of a thing that happened in the world is not to have access to the truth of that thing, either the underlying truth of the thing that those notes were describing, or even what happened in the room at the time. Like, when I take notes, I do my best for them to be fair and accurate. Right. But sometimes when you compare notes to a recording, it turns out that you are full of
not
shit.
Not just sometimes, and I think, every time. Yeah. Record everything. Right. The tell always
but
is
the... But obviously the record everything approach can't work for, you know,
everything.
Couples therapy.
Yeah. So here's a question to the room. So Jeff Flake on 60 Minutes last night was asked, hey, if Kavanaugh was lying to the Judiciary Committee, would that be disqualifying? And he said, oh, yeah, for sure. I presume that what Jeff Flake thought he was answering is if he was lying about the thing that was important. But there's a lot of people making the claim. And again, I find it pretty persuasive that Kavanaugh was lying or at least dissembling or at least being a jerk face about questions that were, in the scheme of things, trivial. Devil's
right.
Triangle.
The boof gotcha.
The Ralph Club. Sensitive stomach. Everyone knows. I eat a can of beans. I'm just puking. And that's why we called our Keg City Club the Ralph Club. Like, no, absolutely not. That's not what was going on here. So here's the question. Given that this whole thing is totally unfair, in many respects, like the late hit of putting this in the process instead of processing this confidential claim back on July 30th, the point that Lindsey Graham made, which I think has a lot of persuasiveness behind it, like this is a late hit designed to derail, it's maximum bad faith. Given that, and given all of that, is that we just ended up in this place. Nonetheless, that's the place that we're in. And here we are talking under oath, a judge, presumably with judicial temperaments and elsewhere. If he's lying about this trivial bullshit about his high school, is that a disqualifying event, even given that precursor, Nick?
Yeah, I think it is.
Boom! Do we all stand in agreement of that? See?
No. I mean, it is perhaps disqualifying in that it is stupid. It is not disqualifying in that it is illegal or, you know, perjurious or...
Yeah, we're not talking about, like, it's not a court of law, but I think
under,
if, for instance, I mean, if you, you can't put up with that. And that's like, this is one of the arguments that people made for Bill Clinton, that everybody lies about sex.
Again, it's all like these tiny, tiny little fine lines in a mesh of darkness, to be Matt Welsh. But like, let me give you back a hypothetical. Say that Kavanaugh was perfectly truthful about literally every single thing in that entire proceeding, except the definition of Devil's Triangle. Just that. Say that he looked at the C-SPAN cameras and he was like, I can't do it. I cannot say on C-SPAN what this thing is.
Which is, what is the theory, Catherine? Tell us.
I don't think it's a theory. I feel like Urban Dictionary is delight right now.
What does Urban Dictionary tell us?
Urban Dictionary tells us the Devil's Triangle is a three-way with two men and one woman. Now, yeah.
I can speak as somebody, and I guess Matt is
Senator,
also in
Nick,
this category.
I'm so scared of how this sentence
no,
is going to end.
Say, I
Senator,
never,
it's a three-way with two men and one
I never heard that phrase in the 1980s.
True,
sure.
But...
That was too specific. Say he was perfectly truthful about literally everything except that. Y'all going to tell me, sorry, buddy, no Supreme Court appointment for you?
So I think this raises the question of the context of the small lies. Let's say we determine that there are some clear small lies, Devil's Triangle, the boofing, the Ralph Club, etc. Yep, we're going to have to keep using these words. Thank you. Thank you, fate. We're going to have to keep using it. So let's say that we determine that he's definitely lying about some of those things, that in fact we have him writing in somebody else's yearbook, here's what boof means, and it wasn't what he said in front of the Senate, right? Something like that. If we also determined that the primary allegation against him was definitely and for certain false, with, say, the same level of something like documentary evidence, right? You know, a house plan and a confession, just to bring up the old Ed Whelan situation. Dr. Ford did say, I can draw you a sketch. She brought up the house plan stuff, brought that into the discussion there. Right. So it would be one thing if we found out he was lying about the small things and was had been put in this situation unfairly because he was not the person he was never involved in what Dr. Ford alleges. It would be another thing if we found out he was lying about the small things and lying or perhaps misremembering about the main allegation. And it would be yet another thing. And I think this is the situation we're in. If we strongly suspect he's misleading people about some of these small things and basically don't have enough information to judge the main allegation,
you know,
and that is
about
the problem.
A Supreme Court
is
justice that, here, and it's like if he should have been. I think he should have come clean then. If he's lying about the devil's triangle, you know, like yeah, because and he should have used some of his fury to be like, what the fuck are we talking about here? I mean, you know, because you know,
but I actually do think he kind of tried to do that, and he just failed in the execution. Like this is another thing that we've been talking about here in the office, and I think. As a nation, is what we saw from Kavanaugh an upwelling of his true personality spontaneously in response to what happened in that room? Was it a planned strategy? And if it was a planned strategy, was it a botched strategy? Right? Like, I think he decided to go in. I think he went in and he was like, okay, because he's not an idiot, right? Like, he says, this is an important day. I have to think importantly about how I'm going to face this day. And he said, if I go in cold and bloodless and I just, you know, soberly deny, people will think that I'm lying.
And, so and said, I think specifically he decided that after seeing some people say he was a little too bloodless in the Fox News interview and pointing to the Clarence Thomas remarks decades ago during his confirmation, you know, which is why it was the Clarence Thomas speech, you know, about the high-tech lynching that is widely considered kind of the turning point for his confirmation.
Right. So he says, OK, I need to show that I am an aggrieved party, that I have been done wrong here. And he said, OK, so I need to bring some of that sense of essentially being victimized to this hearing. And then he did it. And I think even Kavanaugh partisans will largely agree that it didn't come off flawlessly, probably at least in part because it's dangerous to tap into strong feelings, you know, like an attempt to sort of titrate them for the C-SPAN audience. He missed a little bit on that. And, you know, I think for him to sort of have come in there and said, like, OK, I need to try to generate this Clarence Thomas moment. I need to try and sort of show people how this affected me, like he swung and missed. But I also think, you know, to the character question, it's different than if he went in there trying to keep his chill and then lost it.
I think I'm now convinced that I agree with Nick that if he is lying, which is to say that he is knowingly providing a false definition
of
the devil's triangle. But I think we don't know that he definitely is.
I hate this.
I think we don't know that what slang meant in 1982, because the whole nature of language is that it's contingent and it changes over decades. So I don't think. And as
so
Nick
stoned.
Said, Nick does not recall. Nick doesn't recall that term meaning what the UrbanDictionary.com, which didn't exist 35 years ago.
The dot coms didn't really exist
35, right? So we don't know that he is definitely lying about that. If he were knowingly providing clearly false information to Congress, I think I can go along with.
I mean, we can say that about
a Supreme Court justice.
Boofing, right?
Yeah, and the boofing business, and maybe even the Ralph Club.
Here's what he's lying about,
well,
Peter. Here's
he
what he's lying
the
about.
The Ralph Club was throwing
tell
up.
Us, Matt.
He just
what he's
was
lying about,
talking
and,
about it.
And Nick will back me up here because Nick and I occasionally have had a drink in our lives, perhaps even in our early 20s.
Or this morning.
He is lying. Or this morning? Is that what someone said? I'm staring at this single barrel rum here, and it's tempting me. No, he's
Daiquiri time.
He is he's lying about the extent or he's dissembling about the extent of his drinking. He was asked stuff like, did you ever wake up not fully remembering what happened the night before? And he's like, no. And then he tried to throw it back at people. That's just untrue. He drank so much more than I did in high school. And I have plenty of times in high school, I mean, of the six times that I drank, where I don't remember what happened the night before. The testimony that's coming from his, and again, this is not under oath, but the journalistic testimony coming in from a lot of people who knew him in college and elsewhere are like, bro drank a lot and we got super wasted a lot. And that was a bad period for a bunch of us there. That's an important
I'll push back a little bit on this. I'll push back just a little bit on this, which is that even amongst people who are drunks, not just regular drinkers, not just heavy drinkers, but serious drunks, the blacking out is not a universal
sure,
thing.
But
and
waking
so
up in your
if
clothes,
his, if his
he
argument
has woken
is,
up in his
he's,
clothes.
I agree.
God damn it. He absolutely has woken
I agree
up in his clothes.
That he
I'll
is that he is at minimum he is strategically downplaying his high school and his high school drinking. That's I agree with that for that's for sure a thing that he is doing. Again, I'm less than perfectly confident. I'm not saying he is definitely representing his drinking experiences perfectly accurately enough to be true, capital T, true under oath, true. But I'm not, again, I'm just not totally confident about that he is lying about those things versus shading his description of the event in ways that are, again, if he thinks he's innocent, how much does he really want to reveal, right? Like, I'm not saying it's exactly the right strategy, but shading your experience, like, if you think you're innocent and you shouldn't be in this position to begin with, should you go in front of Congress and be like, I was a teenage drunk every single night?
Yeah. Right, and that's, like, the parallel
maybe,
to that is
maybe
also...
Maybe you should. I don't
The parallel
don't know.
To that is also this argument that you were hearing, I would say, you're hearing it now, less now post-hearing, but pre-hearing, there was this argument from sort of anti-Kavanaugh folk that was basically, well, if he had acknowledged that something like this might have gone down and apologized and done penance, we would not be baying for his blood in this way.
That's
a transparent lie. Yeah. That's obviously untrue, right? And that was a line that people were floating. And at least part of the reason people were floating that line was to try to elicit something like that from him so as to then completely destroy him, right? And I feel like this is the origin of the boofing dissimulation.
Can that be the headline, the title for this episode? The origin of the boofing dissimulation? Yeah,
that's not the right word. What word am I trying to say?
Dissembling.
Dissembling.
Dissemblage.
So, you know, perhaps a more fruitful line of inquiry, Matt, would be to ask, regardless of this particular episode, do we want to live in a world where, you know, your high school life and like shit that you write on your high school yearbook, you know, is in play when you are in your 50s. It seems to me if there's a serious crime, you know, that is not acknowledged and that has never been accounted for, you know, that's one thing. But we're now at a point in politics and political discourse, and I think this brings us towards Jeff Flake in a way that's worth talking about, you know, like, something has seriously gone fucking wrong. And like, we need to change. I don't know. I've said this every week for however many weeks, like, we need to change the conversations that we're having in the political arena, because this is fucking batshit crazy. I mean, it's insane. Like, it just, we have to stop doing this. And so, I don't think we can let whatever happens to Kavanaugh, and I care less and less about him as a human being the more this goes on. Like, I don't really care. I don't even care about the Supreme Court anymore. You know, like, we need to be having like serious conversations about, in the political arena, about politics and especially about policy. And we're just not doing
it. Eat it, Arby's.
Catherine, let's talk about America's Hamlet. Jeff Flake here. The Lindsey Graham argument, which I referenced before, is basically that Democrats are always moving the goalposts. That is what this whole thing is about. And that's why every, you know, if we could just delay this by another week, then we'll get some other crazy charges out there. We'll get Avenetti 2.0 out there. And it's just all an attempt to run out the clock so that presumably they, you know, gain a seat in the Senate in November and kind of go from there. And so therefore, this argument goes, any delay is only incentivizing the world in which every yearbook is pillaged for every little crappy thing. And so therefore, we should vote right away and we shouldn't do a flake-flake thing. What is your response to that line of argument?
I think that flake's call for an extra week is a tiny drop in the river of us going that way already. I think that this whole spectacle has already provided more than enough incentive for anyone who had kind of dirt digging, private investigator sending, high school classmate interviewing impulses. Like, they are on it. They have the model has been proven whether or not Kavanaugh is confirmed. And asking for an extra week is basically neither here nor there. I am sympathetic to Jeff Flake, you will be not at all surprised to hear, because he's trying to be a reasonable dude in an unreasonable world. And nobody likes the reasonable dude. The reasonable dude is sort of a stick in the mud. He gives goofy interviews with some other semi-reasonable dude where everyone's like, that sounds fine, but let's be real, son. Shit is serious. And he's trying his best. We're all just trying our best.
But we're not. I mean, most of the people on the Judiciary Committee are not trying their
best.
We
are. Most of us are. Like, I think those guys even, and this is maybe where you and I differ. Like, I think those guys are trying their best, given what they perceive the stakes to be.
Lindsey Graham went out of his way to make sure that Merrick Garland did not even get a confirmation hearing. Because he could. The Republicans and the Democrats are acting, virtually all of them, in absolute bad faith. And they're primarily responsible.
I think they are acting the way they are because they think it is justified based on the ends. And I think we can disagree about the ends. We can disagree about whether means justify the ends. But I think you can say they're violating the rules of the game, as we've generally agreed to them. I think that's a fair claim. But I don't think that it's fair to say these guys are, like, messing around just to mess around. They're messing around because they're trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think that this is the time, not that it's ever not the time, but for to quote Jules from Pulp Fiction, the path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the inequities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men.
Wow.
That was complete.
I really hope you were reading that off your stomach tattoo. You had it done facing upwards.
It's actually, yeah, it's one of those, necklace.
It's
ones.
On my eyelids.
One of the interesting things, Gallup tracks trust and confidence in various institutions, including the Supreme Court. And it was in August, the last time the Supreme Court cracked 60%, which was a common thing, was in 2009. And since then, it's been in the, it's gotten as high as 53%. That was actually a month or 2 months ago. I think it'll be down, but it's more in the mid-40s. And whatever happens, you know, the Supreme Court, which was normally seen as one of the institutions in America that was more, you know, kind of honest and trustworthy, it's sinking too.
Well, I mean, part of that is the seat that Kavanaugh is replacing. Mm-hmm. It's people freaked out to some extent when Gorsuch was put in place, nominated and confirmed. But that's because he was replacing Scalia, and people basically saw Gorsuch as roughly continuing in the line of Scalia's jurisprudence. And Kennedy was the swing vote. And so when Kennedy stepped out, Kennedy was what was keeping, in a lot of people's minds at least, Kennedy was what was keeping the court in something like a rough ideological balance. And we could, of course, have a full hour of discussion on whether that is true or not and the role of Kennedy. But that was a widespread perception. And I think people correctly believe that Kavanaugh is more conservative, perhaps by a large margin, than more conventionally and traditionally conservative than Kennedy was. And so putting Kavanaugh on this court would make the court significantly more conservative than it has been in generations, and that explains an awful lot of the stakes and the reaction to his nomination.
And yet, this morning, The Reason Roundup by Liz Nolan Brown, you should subscribe. You can get it in your inbox.
It's excellent.
She rounds up the fact that we have a bunch of stuff coming up in the Supreme Court. And like it's to me, it was a good reminder that, there's been this kind of meme in Washington, partially because our candidates for president have typically been so awful recently, I think, as well as many candidates for Congress, that like the only thing that matters is the court. And this is, of course, the Butt Gorsuch phenomenon. But it's more than that. And just a reminder that like not every Supreme Court decision is should we repeal Roe v. Wade? Like coming up here, we have a case about dried up tree frog sex ponds and whether they should limit property rights. We've got stuff about
we call them the Devil's Triangle, where I'm from.
Yes, we do call them that. Oh, actually, fun fact, which I'm going to briefly interrupt myself to say, you guys have a name for the little bit of grass between the sidewalk and the street? Do you have a word
no.
for that?
The tree box?
So it's the place where the tree boxes are. But more broadly, that thing my family has always referred to as the Devil Strip.
Huh. Fascinating.
It's an Ohioism, I think. Hmm. Anyway.
Fascinating.
Fascinating. It's just devils everywhere. There's some wholesale liquor cases coming up. This is to just say that like the Supreme Court has a lot of say about weird things in our lives, but also not every Supreme Court decision is quite as like high drama as people seem to be making it out to be.
Assumption on the part of a lot of people, I'm not 100% sure this is right, is that ultimately a Kavanaugh court at least could and perhaps would overturn Roe v. Wade. And so, again, it comes back not just to the role of the court and the role of Kennedy as the swing vote, but one particular case that is exceptionally high stakes for both sides on
right.
on
but
this.
Even there, don't you think it's a reasonable prognostication? And in fact, we have published this at Reason to say, well, the words repeal Roe v. Wade contain a more dramatic outcome than what is actually likely to come, at least in the next, several years, even if Kavanaugh takes the court, right? That it will be like some incursions on that right, more permissions to the states.
I think it's very unlikely. Yeah. I mean, look, I think it's very unlikely that abortion ends up flatly illegal in every state of the United States. On the other hand, I think it's at least within the realm of possibility that a Kavanaugh court sometime in the next decade could rule on abortion in a way that allows for states to significantly curtail abortion access.
I think the distinction between that and total repeal is like the extremity of the likely outcome is determining lots of people's moral calculus about how hard they should go in this hearing.
I think there's also,
and I think people are a little wrong about
I
it.
I think there's also the fact that there's a sense which may not turn out to be true at all, but both with the midterms but also in 2020, that the Republican Party is at a historic high in terms of being in elected office at the local, state, and federal level, and that's peaking, that it's not going to last, and so that it becomes this odd thing where you get to lock in, at least for a while, a conservative court right as Republicans are kind of passing from the scene in terms of legislative power. The other thing that, and Matt, I hope that you still follow this type of stuff with the pleasure that I do. I mean, the shrinking numbers of people who identify as either Republican or Democrat is amazing. I mean, like, we called it in the Declaration of Independence, however many years ago, that was 7 years ago. But it's, it's happening because people are sick of this shit. I mean, and it is, it's bad faith arguments. I disagree. Like, I don't think if you say to Dianne Feinstein, she's not saying, oh, I'm going to use by any means necessary. She is pretending that she's arguing in good faith, and she's either an idiot or a liar. And it adds up to the same thing. I think the Republicans are the same way. They're not willing to admit that they are breaking the rules that they use to justify their righteousness whenever they're on the losing end of something.
I want to follow up on that, Nick, but before we leave Kavanaugh in its entirety, Catherine, with your devil's airstrip or whatever the hell that thing was, commented, made me realize that, hey, you grew up around the greater Washington, D.C. Area. Do you have anything, any perspective to give to us that we wouldn't otherwise regionally have, is sequestered as we were in our various enclaves, about lingo and culture that might have some bearing on the case that we have before us?
Failing that, just tell us how you feel about Georgetown Prep.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that I think my vintage is a little off to speak authoritatively about the slang, but I will say that I have I generally eschew class war and class resentments as a mode of discourse. However, as grumpy as I am about not being able to wear my Yale t-shirt occasionally for a while here, I will pay any price to see Georgetown Prep's name dragged through the mud.
Oh, all right. Very good. Well,
I just like those dudes in my time had, of course, there were many sterling examples of individual Georgetown Prep humans who were lovely.
Sound like there were that many.
However, the general rep of Georgetown Prep was entitled frat douche bro, and Kavanaugh is certainly not taking a dent out of that.
So you're saying there's an eternal squee?
The eternal squee of the thoughtless mind. That's where we are.
So Nick referenced the independence poll. Gallup measures this stuff and does it about every month and has now for at least 20 years. And I just wanted to point out some bits of it. It came out pretty recently, the latest numbers here. Self-identified people, they're asked, like, in politics as of today, do you consider yourself a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent? And the latest numbers as of September are 44% for independents, 26 for Republicans, and 27 for Democrats. There's a couple of things interesting about this poll. One, this is kind of normal in general. This is what we've seen in the long trend. Goes like this, except a little bit more. But what's abnormal about it is kind of interesting, which is to say we are heading into an election. The only times when that 44 number goes down to like the high 30s is usually right around November of an even numbered year. The last time that I think independents were not the single highest number in this particular poll was right after the 2012 election. Republicans haven't been above 33% since December 2006. Democrats haven't been that high since December 2013. But every single time, if you look, 14, 16, 12, 10 down the line, it's been down. What will be interesting to see in the wake of all of this, because this has been a moment in which everybody's two-partiness has arisen, and this is going to become the Kavanaugh hearings. I mean, this is going to become, I believe, a pretty strong motivational force in the election. It'll be interesting to see what this poll looks like in October, because that's when it usually tends to suddenly, oh, I remember that I myself identify as a Democrat because screw those guys, or whether we really are at a kind of a point of no return. I wonder in these moments, Catherine, maybe you can address this a little bit, or Nick or anyone, how do you get the peoples to unclench and to free themselves from them? What's a little carrot you can like drag in front of them and say, see how all the mad that you have right now? The answer is not to punch the other guy in the mouth when it is so absolutely emotionally satisfying and in some cases the absolute correct thing to do to punch them in the mouth. I am soliloquizing here just a little bit, but I mean, there's a reason why everybody hates Jeff Flake, and it's very funny to write a piece, as I did over the weekend, pointing out that everybody hates Jeff Flake, and people respond, dude, screw you. I hate Jeff Flake, which is the universal response to this. It is emotionally unsatisfying, is it not? Nick Gillespie, I'm going to turn it to you, to be in this kind of inherently squishy, temperamental, I don't belong to your fight clubs.
I'm not sure what the question was, to be quite honest, Matt.
It's like, how do you make that an attractive place in a moment of high partisan dudgeon? Or are we doomed to relive this every 2 years, every 2 weeks, every 2 months?
Yeah. I mean, having said that, I do think that the, you know, the possibility the parties need to reinvent themselves because they can't, you know, when you can't get 50% of the population to vote for your presidential candidate, which happens, you know, pretty frequently. I mean, Obama was able to pull it off. But other than that, and, you know, Bush against John Kerry briefly. But it's getting harder and harder to do that. And the parties have sorted into a conservative party and a liberal party, broadly speaking. And those positions and the policies that they put forward are pulling fewer and fewer people. There will come a point where they need to reinvent themselves also out of political reality. I mean, the Republican Party is, you know, they're losing the female vote. They've completely given up on the minority vote, and they won't be able to maintain themselves over time if they give up that. And they're going to have to reconstitute themselves in a way that appeals to different polities. The Democrats also face the same problem. I mean, if you can't beat Donald Trump as a presidential candidate, you got a real problem. And I think they know that. They're looking to reinvent themselves, it seems, some of them anyway, along the lines of the democratic socialist idea, which is not going to play very well because all of the, among other things, all of the polls that show that 18 to 29 year olds have a positive view of socialism also point out that you know, the same people have a higher percentage of favorability towards the term capitalism and free enterprise. So I think we're going to see the party shift as, you know, economic reality dictates and financial reality comes to government.
Catherine, you are probably the most anarchistic among the four of us, not probably, definitely. And you are surely aware that among the group of libertarians who hate Jeff Flake the very most are your co-anarchist bedfellows who spit on his soon-to-be-dug grave and find all of our ministrations and wailing to be comical, worthy of mockery. So how do you square your rabble-rousing, burn-it-all-down with your lingering affection for squishy moderates like Jeff Flake?
I think that you have indulged in unfair stereotypes of anarchists, friend.
And it's a dodge.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm going to dodge. I'm going to do the dodge, but I think it's a legit dodge, which is you know, you can burn it all down slowly and strategically. You can burn down.
It's a controlled burn.
It's a controlled burn. Yeah. That's literally, I am calling for a controlled burn of the state. I want to dig moats. I want to have a bunch of dudes standing around with extinguishers, and then I want to be like, first, burn down that one.
And one of those dudes is Jeff Flake.
One of the dudes with the fire extinguisher making the controlled burn possible is Jeff Flake. And I think we can all agree, Jeff Flake in a firefighter outfit is something we all want to see.
That is beautiful.
This is how you do a metaphor, by the way.
There you go.
I
made that for you, Matt. That's my special present to you today.
Thank you. Let's transition out of all of this nonsense and talk important nonsense to discuss, to be sure. But let's talk about more cultural, non-political things out there, what we have been consuming in the entertainment brain-feeding sphere. And I am going to go first, in case it triggers any amens or hallelujahs out there. There's a Twitter feed that only has about 180 followers, all of whom I think work for Reason, even though we don't have many employees. It's called Reason -50, which is an allusion to countdown, our anniversary year this year, our 50th anniversary. And it's some person out there, I don't think that we know that who that person is, who is looking at the very, very first issues in 1968 of Reason and kind of doing a deep thought dive and commenting on the, you know, where that conversation has gone 50 years from now. How prescient was it? How if it was not, or why not? And of particular interest for me, since I've been working on a feature for an upcoming issue of the magazine about the founder of Reason, Lanny Friedlander, those 1968 issues were just basically Lanny Friedlander talking about a pretty impressive variety of subjects ranging from, you know, the post office, the future of telecommuting, media law, why student protesters are illiberal, and war, and institutionalization, a whole bunch of different things. And what I particularly like about it, as someone who's been interested in kind of trying to chase the memory of who Lanny Friedlander in particular is, but also kind of the roots and history of reason, is that this person, whether he or she intends to or not, is kind of rescuing or giving proper credence to Friedlander as a writer and thinker, because it's for understandable reasons, a lot of people look at him as a very creative visual artist and designer. He was way ahead of his time on using Helvetica and white space and a bunch of other stuff. He was just a really striking designer that will probably be his lasting kind of artistic legacy. Yet he was also a very, very interesting writer and thinker. And so it's a great follow for those who are interested in libertarian history, the history of reason, and such like. And with that, I will move to Catherine.
By the way, the author of that feed is Rob Zorka.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Rob.
We do know who is that. I want to recommend what is really just a follow-on Peter Suderman recommendation. He had suggested that I read Jennifer Egan's Manhattan Beach, which I did on vacation. I went back for a little more Jennifer Egan this weekend with Look at Me, which is a novel from a while ago, maybe like 2009 or something.
I think it's actually quite a bit.
Is it older? I think this says reprint 2009. So yeah, maybe 2001, actually. It's good. It's good in the same way that Jennifer Egan's other book is good. It's extremely atmospheric. It's got lots of evocation of place. I strongly recommend.
Very good. Peter, Spider-Man?
Spider-Man. I spent the weekend playing the PlayStation 4 exclusive game Spider-Man. It's... If you like Spider-Man, if you are the kind of person who could possibly like Spider-Man, if you have ever spent most of your childhood thinking about Spider-Man, this is the game for you. It is, in every possible way, a kind of a Spider-Man simulator. And I think one of the most amazing things about the game, since it is the Amazing Spider-Man, one of the most amazing things is how fully they capture, like, the entirety of the Spider-Man experience. All of the things that you might imagine Spider-Man doing, you can do as Spider-Man in this game. The other thing that I would say is that it is part of a new wave that I think really started about a decade ago with the Batman Arkham Asylum game, where they decided, instead of making sort of a shitty, cheap spin-off, like sort of a intellectual property licensed game, they would actually make a really good Batman game by hiring one of the writers who worked on Batman the Animated Series and a bunch of the voice talent from Batman the Animated Series, and really kind of make it not just a... Again, not just kind of a knockoff that was just sort of designed to collect money quickly, but let's actually capture the Batman experience and what Batman's about, and let's bring on good writers, good actors, and tell a real story about Batman in his world here. They've done the same thing with Spider-Man. Dan Slott, who wrote the Spider-Man comics for maybe a decade or more, a bunch of the main comics, is one of the writers here. The writing and voice acting is really quite good. And so it's really part of a kind of an interesting development in a world where a game like this 25 years ago would have been cheaply, quickly produced, would have not really felt like a Spider-Man game. It would have just felt like some very conventional punching game that they skinned Spider-Man stuff onto. And instead, they've spent several years in development. This was announced in 2016, just came out this last month. They've really thought about, well, what is it that is, what are all the components of the Spider-Man experience, and how can we combine all of them into a game and make them fun and allow you, Peter Suderman, Catherine Mangu Ward, the player of this game, whoever that is, to engage with the world in the way that Spider-Man would. It is a simulator designed to teach you how to think like Spider-Man.
Just to bridge the gap between my thing and Peter's thing, the co-creator of Spider-Man, Steve Ditko, early contributor to Reason Magazine, mm-hmm. under Lanny Friedlander, 1969. He drew panels for us. Nick?
Yep. Ditko was a confirmed objectivist and wrote some strange stuff.
What was his confirmed objectivist name? subjective is confirmation
name. Mr. A. He had a cartoon character, a hero. I spent a lot of the weekend watching college football. In the top 25, there's about 12 undefeated teams, and there were a couple of fantastic games, most of which I missed the end of because it looked like particularly Ohio State, which is the alma mater of my older son, Jack, looked like they were going to lose poorly in a game that they should have been winning. And so I turned it off, and they managed to pull out a win at Penn State. In an incredibly exciting game that I had to watch the ending of, knowing how it ended, which was kind of frustrating.
College
football, like, you know, and obviously we're going into the baseball playoff season, and it's been a pretty amazing season in baseball, you know, but college football is really great right now.
I mean, for slavery. Anyway.
That's true. That's true.
That is all the involuntary servitude, or voluntary servitude in that case, that we have time for this week. You know what to do, people. You subscribe to this thing on iTunes, you write reviews, you rate us, and et cetera. And stay tuned throughout the week for other great podcasty content. Thanks for listening. And next week, stay tuned for us talking about Brett Kavanaugh.
Mm.
Goodbye.